Hello there. Good evening from India. This is Abhivardhan from Internationalism Global Podcast, and we are live for the sixth episode of Indus Think. This is a very interesting episode because we are discussing a very interesting book written by author Ganesh Swaminathan. So we have Ganesh Swaminathan ji with us, and his book is entitled From the Beginning of Time. Now I'll give a little bit briefing about the author, of course, and the book, and then we will start an interesting discussion about this book. My intent is that this book a lot covers the scientific aspects of physics and how the references come from the Mahapuranas and the Upuranas wherever necessary. And the depiction is so easy and lucid that it actually also makes us understand how cultural policies work and how narratives provide an understanding of science. So I was much interested to have a discussion with Ganesh ji, and actually I thought to have it someday. So I would like to introduce Ganesh ji to everyone. So basically, Ganesh is an engineer from IIT Delhi. He's in the corporate world, and he has been interested in space science for a long time from his time in school. So when he completed his master's in business administration from IIM Ahmedabad, he spent most of his time in technology. And his fascination with the Mahapuranas and other texts has been there. So through this book, Ganesh ji has actually tried to make and show how the parallels to space science are available in ancient texts like the Mahapuranas and the Upuranas and so on. So let's begin with the discussion. And Ganesh ji, welcome to Indus Think.
Thank you very much, Abhivardhan. Thanks very much for having me on your podcast. Really appreciate it. I thought, like we discussed earlier, I thought it'd be useful for your audience to have a brief idea of what the book is about. The book is, as you probably have gathered by now, it is not intuitive. It's not intuitive for most people. It's not what you would expect. So I just want to have a very brief presentation that will give them some sense of what the book is about, so that they can, it'll help them, it'll give them some context to follow the discussion that we'll have, okay?
Sure, definitely.
Can you see my screen?
Yes, sir, it's visible.
Okay, wonderful. So what I'm going to talk to you is about the universe of the Puranas, right? And so let's go ahead. And so many of us know the Puranas, we know most of it through the stories. The Puranas contain many stories about the sun, the moon, the stars. And the book demonstrates that these stories portray a few things. First thing is that these stories form a consistent description of the universe. And I underline the word consistent because, you know, you read of a story of the sun, you hear of the story of Ganga, you hear a story of the moon, and you wonder if they have something in common. Is there a common narrative that kind of binds all of these together, or are these just, you know, completely different in time and space? And the book demonstrates that it is possible to build a narrative that is very consistent, number one. Right? It's a very consistent thread of narrative that you can build around this. The second thing is that the narrative that is built is very close to science. So I use the word very close and not identical because first thing is there is no intent to say that everything was already known or something of that sort, right? So the book first explains the science and then explains the what the Puranas say and then lays them out together and leaves it for the reader to make up his mind or her mind, right? And I say close to science because science is not static. Science is constantly evolving, and that's the nature of science. We get more evidence, and as you get more evidence, you formulate new hypotheses and new knowledge arises from that, right? And so science constantly evolves. So at the current state of science, we have to say that it's quite close. And finally, it includes many recently discovered concepts. So it's not just Newtonian physics we're talking about. There's a lot that was discovered in the last few decades that the Puranas talk about and the book reflects, right? And so what I'm what follows is a very brief sample of what the book contains. So I'll just give you a sense of what is possible. So you obviously have to read the book to know everything that it contains, but at least it'll give you what is the scope of the book, broadly speaking. The first thing is the shape and size of the Earth, right? The Earth. So we all think that we all know the Puranas are about 2,500 to 2,000 years old, and everybody thought that the world was flat at that point in time. The Puranas actually have many references to a spherical Earth. And here is an example. It says, this your boar form consisting of three Vedas, the sphere of the Earth supported by your tusk, appears shining like a great, enchantingly beautiful Kulaparvata with a cloud resting on its peak. So it's from the Bhagavata Purana, Book 3, Chapter 14. So I want to point out a couple of things. First thing is, obviously, I have underlined sphere, right, to show that it talks about the Earth as a sphere. The second thing is, there are a lot of places where I mention verses from the Puranas, right? And I just don't say that the Puranas say this or that. The book quotes the specific Purana, the book or the chapter or the section, and at the verse number. So in case anybody wants to go back and do some more reading, they are free to do so. They know where to start, and they can get to the detail very quickly. And finally, I'm using an English translation. Even though a lot of the Puranas are in Sanskrit or in Hindi, there is no Devanagari in this presentation. It's all in English. And this is a translation by a board of scholars appointed by the government of India in the 50s. So the government of India wanted the Puranic texts to be translated to English and made accessible to the whole world, essentially, right? And because you have 18 Mahapuranas and another Upapuranas, they appointed a whole team of scholars to undertake this task. And this is the output of, this is the translation that they came up with. So it's not something that I have made up to kind of fit my narrative. Okay, let's move on. Let's look at the size of the Earth, right? There's a verse in the Vayu Purana which says, from the Kumari to the source of Ganga spreading along the north in a circuitous way, it extends to 9,000 yojanas. Now, Kumari is Kanyakumari, and the source of Ganga is Gangotri, and these are points on the map that we know today, and the physical distance is about 2,600 kilometers. So if 2,600 kilometers is 9,000 yojanas, a yojana is about 2,802.28 kilometers is one yojana. Now, in many places, in many of the Puranas, the Jambudvipa is described as being 100,000 yojana in extent, and that would mean this is equal to about 28,800 kilometers. And this is close to the actual stretch of land on our planet. Right, and I don't want to go into detail, but you might be able to get a sense of it. Let's move on, right? So we talked about the land, let's talk about the ocean, right? What is the Earth, close to 70% of the Earth's surface is covered by ocean, right? And the scientists now agree that most of the water in the oceans came from outer space, right? Because of the theory on how the Earth evolved, they realized that it could not have been there at the origin of the Earth. And the water came to the Earth in the form of comets and asteroids. Now, comets are basically frozen water and ammonia and methane and so on. When a comet comes into the atmosphere, it just vaporizes, and the water vapor mixes with the atmosphere, and then it comes down to the Earth as rain. Asteroids are mostly rock, and they have about 5% or in some cases 10% water. And again, when it comes to the Earth, because of the heat, it burns up, and then the water gets released, right? Here is the verse in the Puranas. It says, this is from the Brahmanda Purana again, it says, though their waters had been dried up when Agastya drank up the waters, the four oceans became full with the waters of the Ganga once again. So we all know that the Ganga is from outer space, came from outer space. But the descent of Ganga is not just the descent of the water, this descent of this one river onto our planet Earth. It is actually the descent of the waters of the ocean, right? And there are many such references, but I just thought I'd show this to you and see where and tell you where it is, where it aligns with our understanding today. Let's go to the moon, right? The origin of the moon. So the moon is unlike any other in our solar system. It's much bigger in terms of the relative size to the Earth than any other moon in the solar system, right? And the scientists agree that the origin of the moon is best explained by what is called the giant impact hypothesis. And according to this hypothesis, a large planet impacted the Earth, creating a large debris disk, and the moon emerged from this disk. And here's an illustration from, I think, the Universe Sandbox, right? So it shows the Earth, and this proto-moon is called Theia, right? And this moon actually had a collision with the Earth, and you can imagine it was cataclysmic completely, because you're talking about an object the size of Mars. And as a result of this, there's a huge amount of dust that's thrown into space that forms like a disk of debris that orbits around the Earth. And then out of this disk, the moon emerges, literally just emerges out of this this region of space, right? What is interesting is that the impact and the emergence of the moon are both described. The impact is described in the Kalika Purana and the emergence of the moon in the Bhagavata Purana. Yes, I won't go into more detail, but I should give you a sense. Let's talk about the sun, right? So the Puranas have many stories about the sun, and the sun is actually one of the billions of stars, right, in the universe, in the Milky Way, right? And in the first stage of a formation of any star at its birth, it's just a ball of gas that is relatively inert, right? So it's just a ball of gas that collapses on itself from what's called a giant molecular cloud. And its early stage, it produces neither heat nor light. It's just a large ball of gas which continues to collapse. As it continues to collapse, the energy produced by the collapse causes heat and then finally light and then finally nuclear fusion, which is what is believed to be the source of energy for the sun. And here's the verse in the Purana. It says, since he was born dead, Mritha, and as an egg, Anda, Savitra, the sun, is called Martanda by the learned men. This is again in the Kamanda Purana, right? And so I told you the life cycle of the sun has five stages. It is birth, youth, which is a young star. Quite interestingly, even stars have a juvenile stage, a mature stage, which is what we see in the skies today, a red giant stage, and the white dwarf stage. So these are five stages in the life cycle of any star, low mass star. And quite incredibly, there are stories or descriptions in the Puranas that describe each of the stages of the sun's life, right? So this one slide can be a one-hour presentation in itself. And I have made a presentation of this. You can find this in my YouTube channel. And so there's a lot of detail that can be just spread around this one, on this one topic. So let's go to the Brahmanda. So we've talked about the Earth, the Sun, and the Moon, and let's talk about the solar system. So the Brahmanda is the kind of the extended solar system. And the Puranas describe the planets from Mercury to Saturn, right? They don't talk about Uranus and Neptune. And these planets move in an orbit which is very close to the plane of the ecliptic. So the ecliptic is the plane in which the Earth orbits around the Sun. Right, it orbits in a plane around the sun, and that plane is called the plane of the ecliptic. And the planets move in an orbit which is very at a small angle to the plane of the Earth rotating around the sun. Right, and this plane is referred to as the Bhumandala or the extended Earth. Right, and the verse in the Puranas describing the size of the Brahmanda is the entire Earth is remembered as 50 crores of yojanas in extent. And the entire Earth is the extended Earth. And this distance, when calculated, covers a region of space that includes all the planets up to Saturn. Right? Let's go beyond the Brahmanda. Right? So this is probably the most unintuitive of all of these. Right? The Puranas, most of the Puranas talk about sheets that cover a Brahmanda. And so they say the sheets have water, fire, wind, and ether. Right? And so it's hard to imagine that there can be sheets around our solar system. But the reality is that the solar system is hypothesized as being surrounded by a cloud called the Oort cloud, which is actually a shell of space around the Earth, very far away outside the solar system. And it's filled with rocks of frozen volatiles. When I say frozen volatiles, again, mean frozen methane, ammonia, and of course, water, right? This is the source of the long period comets that come from very far away and return to the solar system after more than 200 years later. So this is hypothesized. You can look for it. You can find more details in Wikipedia if you want. And this is what it looks like, right? Here in the center is a solar system, very small. Yeah? And around it, this shell of space is called the Oort cloud, right? And this Oort cloud is filled with these rocks, small rocks of water and ice, of water and ammonia and methane. And so you can see that there is a shell of water that can be found around the solar system, around the Brahmanda. Let's move on, right? Then it talks about a shell sheath of fire. So again, it's very hard to imagine a sheath of fire in outer space. Yes, outer space is bitterly cold. I mean, it's absolute zero is minus 273 degrees centigrade, and outer space is minus 270. So it's really that cold, right? And yet, there is a region of hot plasma that covers the solar system. This is not something that many of us have probably read in school even. And this is measured by the Voyager 1 and 2 space probes as they exited the solar system. So the Voyager 1 and 2 space probes were launched about 40 years ago. And they have traveled for 40 years. They have gone past Pluto and they have exited the solar system. And they ran into this wall of fire. And so you can actually Google NASA wall of fire and you can get all the details, or you can just go into Wikipedia and look for helio sheet. And here is what this looks like. So this is the Earth, this is the solar system, and the Voyager space probe has left the solar system completely. And now it is trapped, it is in the outer edge of the solar system. And it is this hot wall of hot plasma. And when I say hot plasma, I'm not talking about hundreds of degrees. This is 50,000 degrees centigrade, right? It's really hot. I mean, the particles are at that temperature, right? And so that's how far away that it is. And you can find a sheet of fire, literally, around the solar system, just like it says in the Purana. And finally, I want to talk about, you know, beyond all the sheets and all, you have what is called the interstellar medium. And the interstellar medium is the region, the space between the stars, right? And so it is a space between our solar system and the other stars, Alpha Centauri and the various other stars. And this is a place where there's no gravity and there's no light. When I say no gravity, I mean, you talk about weightlessness even in space when you go close to the moon. But there is still gravity, right? But when you go out, when you leave the solar system and get into the interstellar medium, the sun is and all the planets are so far away that they have absolutely no gravity. They have very little gravity that they can affect any celestial body there. And whatever little gravity is there is balanced by the gravity of the other stars in the universe, right? So there are neighboring stars. So effectively, a body that is in motion in this interstellar medium can travel forever, right? Unless it is obstructed by some other body or anything else, right? The second thing is that there is no light. And so this might sound surprising because whenever we look at pictures of space, it's absolutely dark. The reality is when you send a spacecraft outside, the space in the solar system is filled with light. It's filled with sunlight. That's why as soon as a space probe goes out, the first thing it does is that it unfurls a huge solar panel to harness this sunlight and convert it into energy. So it converts it into energy that powers the internal subsystems in the probe. But once it leaves the solar system, it gets into the interstellar medium, the sun itself is like a pinprick of light, right? It's like you see a star in the sky And there's no light from that star. You just see it as a pinprick of light. Our sun becomes a pinprick of light because of the distance at which it is found. And so there's no light. And this region in the Brahmanda Purana is referred to as the Avyakta. So Vyakti means a living being. Avyakta is non-living, essentially. And this is what the verse says in the Purana. It's a very beautiful description. It says, it is endless and unmanifest. It is boundless. It is describing the interstellar medium, right? The space between the stars. It is endless and unmanifest. It is boundless. It has neither beginning nor an end. It is devoid of all activities. It is well known as the extremity of darkness. A very beautiful description, very perfect description of the interstellar medium in the Brahmanda Purana. So to summarize, there's a very detailed cosmology that can be found in the Purana. Very unintuitive, but that's what I found from my reading of about 8 years, right, when I started writing my book. Can be found in the Puranic text. And the verses that I quoted earlier are just a very small sample. There's a lot more detail. And this detail is spread across different Puranas. It's not like you can go to one Purana and one chapter and get all this detail. You have to really look for it across the various Puranas, across the various stories, and amalgamate all these. And the book attempts to tease out this Puranic view of the cosmos, to kind of put all these facts together and try and create this view of the Puranic view of the cosmos of the universe. With that, I'll end my presentation. Thank you. I want to add, there is no obvious explanation for how this information came to be, right? So I have no idea, and I say so in the book explicitly, that there's no obvious explanation, right? But that doesn't mean that the information is not there. So I just want to add that. And then with that, like I said, I want to thank you. And I'll hand you back to Abhivardhan. Abhivardhan, I hope that was interesting to your viewers. And then we can start.
Sure. So I have actually some questions from the passages which you have quoted from various Puranas. And okay, of course, with related to some unitary measures and a few things. Like,
wonderful.
I'm still reading the book and I found it very inquisitive. You actually stated it very interestingly that when it comes to the Puranas and when they create such narratives about the universe, whether it is the geographical aspect of it, like there is a mention of the Jambudvipa, and then there are different dvipas, and we can even discuss about that later. And I really found a few diagrams which are related to it quite interesting. So you say that they in the book that they are either allegorical, like they have some sense of allegory, or they are factual. So by allegory, if you would like to elaborate a little bit about the way the language works and the way it tries to express, what do you think?
Okay. So good question, right? And so actually, let me step back a bit, Abhi, right? When we think of the Puranas, we don't think of these as repositories of knowledge or science or anything like that. The Puranas actually have an enormous amount of science. We don't think of it that way. The Puranas have covered sciences from the from medicine to music, the science of music, right? How the scales are defined and so on and so forth. But we don't know all of those. We don't even imagine all of those. The only thing that we remember are the stories. And that is the beautiful thing about stories, because stories can be handed down orally, even to a non-reader, right? And so the stories are an important part of the Puranas, but the stories are not the entire part. So when the Puranas describe any topic, they do it through a combination of story and description. So let me give you an example right? And I thought the most fascinating example that I found was in the story of the life cycle of the sun. And I'll be honest, Abhi, this is the one that really knocked my socks off when I read it. Right? And I couldn't believe what I was reading, which is why I had to kind of go and go again and again and go back and read my science text and said, is this really possible? So on. So like I said, the life of a sun has 5 stages. So there's a stage of birth, there's a stage of youth, and there's a stage of the current mature stage, and there's a stage of the red giant stage and the white dwarf stage. So let's talk about the current stage. So the current stage, there is a water cycle that we know. I'm sure you know the water cycle, right? Today is the day of the monsoon. So the water cycle is very obvious to me here in Bombay. And so in the water cycle, the sun evaporates the waters from the ocean. It forms clouds. The clouds blow onto the land where it deposits rain. And then the rain fills up the rivers and goes back into the ocean. Right? That's the water cycle. This water cycle was first proposed and this water cycle is described in as many words in the Brahmanda Purana and the Matsya Purana. There is no allegory or anything. It just talks about the sun sucking up the water of the oceans through its rays, the heat of the sun, and then forming clouds and so on and so forth. This is described in detail, right? So there's no allegory or anything. And this was proposed by modern science by a French engineer called, Bernard Palissy. This was in the mid-late 17th century, if I'm not mistaken. The book has the detail. I may not remember the date exactly. It was not accepted by science until the early 19th century. And this you find in detail in a Puranic text, which is 1,500 to 2,000 years old. So there is description that is hard to believe. Right? I want you to understand that. After the current stage of the sun, the sun gets into what is called the red giant stage. Right? So everybody knows the water cycle, even a school child, generally it's kind of school teaching material. What few people know, and I was interested in space science, so I kind of learned about it, was there is a stage that starts about 7 billion years from now of the sun where it's called the red giant stage. And the sun in the red giant, every star goes through this, is not unique to the sun. Every star goes through this as a part of its life cycle. It grows enormously in size. It grows so big in size that the planets like Mercury and Venus get absorbed, are engulfed by the sun. And at its largest size, the Earth just gets engulfed, right? So that's how big the sun is. Hard to imagine this, right? But this is real. We don't need to worry about it because it's like 5 to 7 billion years out into the future, right? So well beyond anything that we need to worry about. So the impact of the sun on the earth is described step by step. It's not one verse. There's a passage of 25 verses in the Brahmanda Purana that describes this in excruciating detail, right? For example, when the sun grows slightly bigger, now imagine the sun becomes close, and it becomes bigger, it gets closer to the earth. When it gets closer to the earth, the temperature of the earth goes up and there is a drought. So it starts by saying that there is a 100-year drought on the planet. Then it goes on to say that the waters of the ocean evaporate. Then it goes on to step by step by step, it says finally the complete earth gets engulfed into the orb of the sun. And this is what, when I read this, I mean, I saw the water cycle and I was curious, but when I read this, I was completely shocked, right? And that's the level of detail that you find even in the description. So that's the description part that is fairly amazing. Now, before it gets to the mature stage, there are two stages. One is the birth of the sun, and the second is the youth stage of the sun. So the birth of the sun is described in allegory. So the sun is described as being born of Kashyapa and Aditi, Kashyapa and his wife Aditi, and the son is a child of Aditi, of born of sage Kashyapa, and that is an allegory, right? And so, but when the son is born, it says it is born as Martanda. It is born as Martanda because when any star is born, it is born as just as a ball of gas, right? And that ball of gas doesn't emit any light, doesn't emit any heat. It's basically inert, right? So it's an inert ball. And so inert means mrita, means non-living. And ball is anda, which means egg. And so it's called martanda, right? So that's the first allegory. The second allegory is the youth stage. That is probably the most fascinating, one of the most fascinating stories that I came across. And what it does is it talks about the young star. So you might have heard of the story of the marriage of Vivaswan and Samjana. Vivaswan is one of the names of the sun, and Samjana is his wife, right? And so the story goes, and it's a very simple story. The story goes that Vivaswan was very young and very active and very bright. And Samjana was his wife, and she got married. But he was so bright that she couldn't even look at him in the face. So she had to keep averting her eyes and look down. And finally, she got so unhappy that she left him, right? And whatever, right? And then her Samjana's father is Vishwakarman, who is the creator of all the physical objects in the universe. So she goes back to her father, and Vishwakarman says, welcomes her and says, and she says, but after a couple of days, he says, listen, you're married. You know, it's against dharma for me to keep you at home for a long time. So you have to go back and figure this out with your husband. And the husband doesn't know that he's very bright. So what the story says is that Samjana goes off to a forest and starts doing penance. And her penance is that the sun becomes less bright. Okay? So the son discovers that his wife is no longer, she leaves an image of her in her place so that the son doesn't realize it. After a while, son realizes that the person that he's living with is just the image and not the original son. So he goes back to Samjana's father and says, hey, where's my wife, where's your daughter? And she says, well, she came here, but she's now gone away. And so the son imagines what has happened, and he realizes that she is out in the forest doing penance, praying for him to be less bright. And so he asks Vishwakarman, can you make me less bright? And Vishwakarman actually cuts the size of the sun. So this is an amazing verse in the Puranas where it says, Vishwakarman mounts the sun on a wheel, right? And then cuts off the parts of the sun that were irregular. Now, first, when you read this, it's completely unintuitive, right? You don't know what to make of this verse. But when you look at the science of it, it is almost perfect. Because what happens is when this ball of gas starts collapsing on itself, it becomes hyperactive, right? It becomes so active, it's just like the young sun. And it's shooting out flares and so on and so forth. And it's a very busy and a very active sun. And it's very destructive because anything that's around it, it'll burn it up completely. But what happens is that when it goes to the mature phase and nuclear reaction starts taking place inside the sun, and there's a lot of science behind it. And I'm not even the expert to explain all of it to you. And, you know, I'm sure you're not interested either. But what happens is that the sun actually collapses in size and becomes completely circular. And so what Vishwakarman does to the sun in terms of decreasing its size and making it circular is exactly what happens to the sun as described by science. It becomes less bright, it becomes smaller, and it becomes less regular. So you have an entire sequence of events which is described by science converted to a story, and most people just remember the story, right? And it's a lovely story. You can read the story and say, oh, this is just a story of marital problems among the gods, right? And that's and how, because of penance, by the act of penance, this thing got resolved. You don't need to know anything about the science of the sun to read this story just like that, right? But you just go, if you are interested in space science, you can say, there is an uncanny resemblance to this, and it's not possible for it to be otherwise. So that's, to me, that level of allegory is really amazing. It was something that really knocked me off my chair, literally. Like, I can't believe I'm reading this, and got me started on this exploration, right? And I said, if a text can write something between allegory and description in such great detail, there has to be a lot more detail here for me to understand. And that kind of started off my process. Sorry, I didn't mean to give you such a long answer, but I wanted to give you a sense of, it's not just an imagination, oh, I just read a story and I thought it was a very good idea. There was a long process that I went through to kind of move from that allegory to the actual science of this. I hope I answered your question. Make sense? Yeah?
I really love it. I was listening to it, and of course, I really liked it. So I appreciate that. So my next question is with related to water. Now, you described that the water cycle has been aptly described in the Puranas. And we know how the water cycle works. It's actually a very interesting process altogether.
Correct.
So One thing with regards to, of course, even in science and even in the Puranas, you have also given depictions that waters have origins from comets, if I'm right.
Yeah. Right.
So one interesting thing which I found in the book was with regards to water, not just about comets and shards and all of these things, but also about a description in the book 1, section 2, chapter 22 of Brahmanda Purana, which states that there is no total destruction of water. The same water gets transformed. Right?
Very, very wonderful.
Yeah. And so about the indestructibility or destructibility of water, if you can describe how the Puranas have elucidated it further, I would be more than happy to listen.
So actually, I'll be honest, there is just one verse, this one verse of this indestructibility of water. I disappoint you, but it doesn't talk of that, but it talks about the cycle. So it doesn't, when we see water boiling, water boiling is not, people have been boiling water for millennia, so it's not something new. So the Puranas make the case that the water may boil off, but it is still water. It is still a different form of water. It does not get destroyed, right? And so it is just changing its form and becoming steam or vapor or a cloud or rain or something of that sort. And so it describes the entire water cycle. So this is the first thing that caught me. And water is one of the most resilient substances, right? I mean, it's a very simple. It's just two molecules, two atoms of hydrogen and an atom of oxygen. You have water. It's one of the magical compounds, if I may say so, in our universe that makes the universe what it is today. So it's indestructible. It's virtually indestructible unless you kind of use electricity or something to separate the oxygen and the hydrogen. And so it describes the entire water cycle. And so when I first read this, I was just struck by the gravity, by the profoundness of this one verse. There is not a lot. There wasn't detail beyond that I could quote to you. But there was one other thing that I want to kind of point out. This again completely knocked my socks off. And I think I mentioned it in the book. It says smoke, and I'm speaking from memory here, so I might not remember. It says smoke is essential for the formation of clouds or something to that effect. And within brackets, it says dust. So not only did they know that clouds formed by the evaporation of water, they understood that to form clouds, you need dust particles, which is what we know in science today, right? So for the condensation of water vapor, you need, if you don't have any particles of dust, you cannot, clouds can't form, essentially, right? And so water, so smoke is essential. Particles of dust that rise up in smoke are essential for the formation of clouds. So that is elucidated in the Puranas. And I'm just surprised how this knowledge exists. I just keep coming back to me. I have read this dozens of times and read it over many Puranas, and it never ceases to amaze me how this knowledge is there. But I don't know that there is more to it than that one verse. It talks about the entire cycle. It talks about the formation of clouds through smoke. It talks about it talks about the clouds coming over land, raining down, feeding the crops, forming rivers, but it does not talk more about the indestructibility.
Yeah. That's really interesting. I wish that there would have been much to discuss about water in that sense, but no issues. Maybe something can be discovered later. So,
right. There's a lot about the water itself. For example, I don't know what's the best way. It talks about the origin of the water, not inside. So, for example, modern science talks about the origin of water. It says there are two regions in space that are the source of comets and comets, basically, right? One is called the Kuiper Belt, which surrounds it's in the plane of the planets, and it's outside of Pluto, right? Beyond Pluto. And then there is the Oort cloud that we just discussed a short while back. So these are the regions in space where there are a lot of comets. Some of these comets come towards the sun, and some of them on their way to the sun get attracted by the Earth, and they fall into the Earth's atmosphere. And the Puranas, so that is known today. But the modern science doesn't tell you where this water came from. They kind of assume that it, you know, it came from the sun. The Puranas actually have a story around it, but I won't go into that. So there's a lot about water that even modern science doesn't tell about. And because modern science doesn't tell us about it, it's very hard to make a one-to-one comparison. So maybe I'll leave it at that. There's a lot about the water and the history of water on Earth in the Puranas. Quite amazing.
That's great. So I'll take a few more questions from my side because I am awaiting if anybody doesn't have any question from YouTube live chat. But okay. I, as have been questioning about, you know, some basic and interesting aspects of the book, I will definitely try my best to discuss a few more of them, and then let's see how it's
possible. Okay.
Yeah. So one of them is regarding Panchang. Now we know what Panchang is. It's about calendars and it's about how the whole lunar and solar thing works. Now, one thing is that you have compared the significance of Panchang with almanacs. So if you would like to describe about that, then I maybe have some follow-up questions.
Okay. So first thing is, I am not an expert on Panchang. So I just want to make that upfront. I was very interested in the Panchang because of one thing that I found which is very interesting. And what was interesting to me was that you know that there are two Panchangs, right? There is a Panchang that you see in North India, which is a different Panchang. The way this is the same 12 squares, right? They are not different. They are just laid out differently in the northern Panchang and the southern Panchang. There's a different Panchang where the 12 squares are in a circle, not in a circle, but in a box around a central box, right? So it's just laid out differently. It's the same information that's presented differently. And the reason I didn't want to go into Panchang was because many people confuse Panchang with astrology. Panchang is So there are two parts to the Panchang. Panchang is a calendar, and there is nothing astrological about a calendar. Calendar is what day of the week is it? And the word Panchang actually means five angas. Five angas above is the 5 days of telling a time. And I'm going to speak from memory here. It is tithi, varsha, Ritu, Tithi, Vara, and so on. There are five things that don't come to my mind. But those are the 5 ways that you define time, basically, right? And so it's just a way of telling time. There is nothing. There is no interpretation or anything. Now you can take that information about not only about telling. It's not just a question of telling time. It's a question of where the planets are in the sky. So remember, it's not just a question of what day of the week is it or what day of the year it is. It is where the planets are in the sky, where the moon is in the sky, where the sun can be found in different parts in during the course of the entire year. So that's what the Panchang does. And an annual Panchang can actually tell you which part of the sky, the let's say a planet like Jupiter or Saturn or whatever, will be on this specific day. It is that accurate. And all of this is done manually for thousands of years. What was that was amazing. Right? Today we have computer simulations for all of this to predict an eclipse. I think tomorrow there's a solar eclipse coming up that can be viewed in some parts of the world. But interestingly, the Indian Panchang, there is no solar eclipse in India because it can't be viewed in India. They can not only tell when the Earth will come up against the sun, when the three will be in the straight line. They can also tell if it will be viewed in India or not. That means they can tell the geographical specificity. That is the level of accuracy. And I still don't understand it. I mean, I'm not a trained astronomer. So I can't tell you that level of detail. So the Surya Siddhanta actually has ways of calculating this manually using paper and pencil and telling you where, when, at what hour the eclipse will happen, and which parts of the Earth you can see it at, which I think is an amazing thing. Today we have, you can go to YouTube and find a video from NASA or somebody else, which is a simulation of, okay, this is where the shadow or the penumbra of the eclipse will pass. What would you do 200 years ago? There was no NASA. The US was a banana republic then. It didn't have anything to go talking about. Where would you get all this information? And yet all of this was computed manually. And today it is computed in the same manual way that it was computed a couple of hundred years ago. So first thing is I thought it was absolutely amazing to find something like that. The second thing, and that is a corollary of this, is that the South Indian Panchanga has one additional level of interest, right? And that I'll just say that, is that because it lays the positions of the planets and the sun and the Rahu and Ketu around the earth, it is what you would observe. For example, the Panchanga is a birth chart, is what happens. So a Janpatri is a birth chart. That means the position of the planets at the time of birth. So basically, it is a view of the map of the heavens at the exact instant of your birth. Can you imagine that? Somebody doing it 500 years ago? You know, that means person ABC was born at this and this time in this place. And therefore, Jupiter was in that corner and on this latitude and longitude. And they could compute it to an enormous degree of accuracy. So they, for the first level of accuracy is a is the 12 constellations, right? Mesha, Rishabha, and so on. So if you divide 360 by 12, that's 30 degrees accuracy. Then you have a 27 stars accuracy, and that gives you a 13.3 degree accuracy. And then you have, you know, you can interpolate between these. You know, each nakshatra has four pada. That means you can have 4 degrees of accuracy. So imagine somebody is sitting in his house or wherever, in some hut or wherever, village or somewhere, and you go to him and say, my son or daughter was born at this and this time, and he will tell you with 1 or 2 degrees accuracy where each of the planets are. To my mind, that is an amazing achievement. That is just absolutely mind-boggling achievement. What you do with it later in terms of saying, okay, he's going to be a bright guy or a rich guy or a poor guy or whatever, that's a separate discussion, right? And I don't claim any knowledge about it. But I think just this, the fact that they could cast a Panchanga with this level of accuracy, where the positions of the planets are so accurately determined, to my mind is a phenomenal achievement. 500 years ago, it was a thousand years ago, it was a phenomenal achievement manually. I thought that was worth mentioning. I don't know that a lot of us think about it that way, right? We look at a Panchanga and we say, oh, this guy's probably an astrologer, he's spinning some stories. And some of us believe in astrology and some of us don't believe in astrology. You know, we each of us have our own likes and dislikes. This is not, but you can't disbelieve the position of the planet. That is an accurate thing. And so what I did was I actually went in and I with some help, I said, okay, let's look at the Panchang for a specific day. And I took an almanac. I took a published almanac. I think it was published by the US Navy, right, if I'm not mistaken. And I compared the positions of the planets, and they're amazingly accurate. And I said, wow. So we had the system for centuries, and we had no clue that we could actually compute this so accurately. So to my mind, the Panchang was a big deal, right, in terms of our knowledge of the science of the cosmos.
Really, that is interesting. But I think if we discuss more on Panchangas, maybe we must be assumed as something in astrology and all that. But anyways, I think it's a very interesting aspect of research which we can go through. So I think a discussion on Panchanga was worth it. So my next question, and then maybe I have just one more final one, and maybe then we'll wrap it up. So okay. One question I have is regarding Jambudvip. Okay. So you described very interestingly, there were two diagrams, I don't remember. One diagram was about certain layers of four oceans, the northern, southern, the western, and the east. Right. And there was second one with the world map, which we follow today. The one which has the United Nations logo and all that, like got from it. The Arctica to Antarctica and so forth, like that. So that I found it very interesting, the way Bharata was described as a peninsular region. So if you can discuss some aspects of that, I would be really happy to take on.
Wonderful. So the first thing is that there is a lot of confusion around Jambudvipa itself, right? And so people people have said, oh, Jambudvipa is it's just India. People have said Jambudvipa is this. The Purana, if you read the Puranas, so there are two texts that I refer to when I talk about the Jambudvipa. One is the Puranas themselves, and the Matsya Purana has probably the most detailed description of Jambudvipa, and the Brahmanda Purana. Both of them have a lot of details about Jambudvipa. And then I took a different text, which is the Surya Siddhanta. The Surya Siddhanta is actually, like we said, it talks about the position of the sun, the moon, and the planets, and where they can be found in the skies, and some of the computations to get to the positions. Right. So I'm not a trained astronomer, so I didn't go into that level of detail, but I looked at the description of the Earth. There's a very clear description of the Earth. And the Earth, by the way, is described very clearly as a sphere in the Surya Siddhanta. And the Surya Siddhanta, the other thing I should add is it's at the same time, it's contemporary to the Puranas. It's also about 1,500 to 2,000 years old. I don't know exactly, but in the same time frame. So, and the Jambudvipa is called out very clearly. So what it does, it says, the Vayu, I think I, in my opening presentation, I talked about that. The Vayu Purana says it very clearly. The Jambudvipa is the Vipa on which all the living beings are found, right? So it is the planet Earth. It is the land mass of planet Earth. Now, I showed you the computation where, there is a verse again in the Vayu Purana which says, the distance between Gangotri, the source of Ganga, and Kumari, Kanyakumari, is 9,000 yojanas. And if you compute that, that is about 0.28, 0.29 kilometers to yojana, and you spread that over 100,000 yojanas, you multiply that by 100,000, it's about 28,800 kilometers. Now, what is 20? So, now, let me stop here. Generally, when one thinks about a yojana, one thinks in terms of what is defined in the Arthashastra, which is about 12.3 kilometers. So, most people multiply 12.3 kilometers by 100,000 and say, it describes the Earth as 1.2 million kilometers, and so, it can't be the planet, right? The verse here very clearly describes what's the relation between these two, right? So, in the Vayu Purana, the linkage is actually shown between the, and the Puranas have at least four different conversions of the yojana, not just one. And so you have to use this conversion of the yojana because it describes against a piece of land. And this 28,800, so when you say 1.2 million kilometers, the moon is 300,000 kilometers, right? So nothing makes sense then, right? So you have to kind of say, okay, this is unintuitive and I can't believe anything. Or you go through this and say, okay, this is exact. Now, 28,800 is what they say is the extent of land. And what is the extent of land? So if you draw a line from the tip of India, from Kanyakumari, and it goes all the way over the North Pole to the other side, it goes through North America and goes through South, goes all the way to South America, it will be a little more than half the circumference of the Earth. Right? Because it goes all the way around. And the circumference of the Earth is 40,000 kilometers. And this is 30,000. 28,800 is just shy of 30,000 kilometers. So this is actually the distance from the Kanyakumari to the southern tip of South America. So it's the extent of land mass in the Jambudvipa. Extent of land in Jambudvipa. So that's the first thing. The second thing is the description of the continents. And I thought that was really, so this is the arithmetic that kind of got it, but the description is very fascinating. For example, it says that you have Bharata, and then next to Bharata, you have what is called you have Bharata Varsha, and then you have what is called Ketumala Varsha, which is 90 degrees around the Earth, right? So if you take the circumference of the Earth and go around 90 degrees, you come to Ketumala Varsha. Now, Ketumala Varsha is described very clearly in the Brahmanda Purana as saying the people living there, the men living there, are black and full of vitality, right? So it's a very clear description of the African man, basically, right? He's very strong and he's black skinned, right? Very clear, right? So it not only describes the position of the continent, which is 90 degrees around the circumference of the Earth, but also describes the people living there. Then it goes to the next 90 degrees. The next 90 degrees, you come to what is called the Hiranmaya version, right? So it's the one that comes just the next one around. And that, it says you have the long, and so that is South America. And so you have the River Sita there, which is, oh, there you go, yeah. Go to the next one and it'll be probably more there it is. Yeah. So when you go around it, when you go around from here, you 90 degrees, you come to Africa. You go around another 90 degrees, you come to South America, which is just north of Harivarsa, right? And so when you go through this, then, and it describes the longest river in the world, which is the Amazon River there. Then it describes then north of India, you have what is called the Kimpurusha Varsha. And it has two descriptions of the Kimpurusha Varsha. It says, first thing, the Kimpurusha Varsha is desert, which is what you have the Gobi Desert here in the middle of Kimpurusha Varsha, right? And a very unique feature of the Gobi Desert is that there's a region called the Takla Makan where there are underground channels of water. It goes below the desert. It's a very unique feature to that desert. That means in the middle of the desert, if you drill a hole, you can get a fountain of water. And this is described in the Puranas. It says you can find this in the Kimpurusha Varsha. And further it goes on to describe and says the people living here are of golden yellow skin color. That means, you know, it's the, you know, we talk about the yellow skin people of the, you know, the Chinese race, basically, that kind of occupies this space. So that was very well described. And then you go further up, you have the Ilavrat, before you have the Harivarsha, that's just north of, northwest of Kimpurusha Varsha. And there it says that the people are silvery white in color. And whom do you find in Europe? You have white-skinned people, right? You have people who are of the Caucasoid race, right? They are silvery-skinned people in color, extremely white, extremely fair. And then it goes on further north, you come to the Ilavrata Varsha. And Ilavrata Varsha is basically the region of the North Pole, and it says very clearly, here is a region where the sun doesn't shine very brightly, right? Because in the North Pole, you have 6 months of day and 6 months of night, right? Because the sun, there's no sunrise and sunset like you have at the equator. And so even during the day, quote unquote, the sun just rises for a little bit and then it sets, right? Basically, there's very little sunlight that you can see there. So it's very clearly described that the sun is not very bright there. It's not visible. And then you have the Ramyaka Varsha above it. There's not a lot of detail about Ramyaka Varsha, unfortunately. There's some other cultural stuff that I don't know that outside the reference of this book. Maybe I shouldn't dwell on it too much. But you can see that all the Varshas have been defined, right? All of them, you can how they are matched against what you see against the map of the Earth. Now, this map of the Earth is what you would see if you were above the Earth, right? Not in front of the Earth, right? You're above the Earth. And so why is it above the Earth? Because it's above the Earth because Mount Meru is where the gods are, right? Above Mount Meru is the region of the gods. And so you see the Earth from where the regions of the gods is. And you can see this is called the Northern Polar View of the Earth. And the region below is called the region of the Asuras, basically, right? So I don't want to go into a lot of detail about that. So both of these have been mentioned in surprising detail. So I'll give you a very personal example. This is the part that I probably struggled with most, right? It was very easy for me to decode the sun, the moon, because they have a very distinct story. They are very distinct. The science there is very clear. But I couldn't get a good reading around the Earth. And I think, you know, how is it possible that somebody can describe the phenomenon of what the sun was, of, you know, many billion years ago and not get confused about what the Earth is, right? Because if you're not reading carefully, you can't get to this. And so what I ended up doing is I actually printed out all the references to the of the Jambudvipa in at least four or five Puranas, and I kept reading it over and over and over again and saying, there has to be some detail here that I'm missing, and finally I could put all of this together and come up with a composite view of the Jambudvipa. So, but I think I feel that this is complete. It matches up with all the references to Jambudvipa in the Puranas and in the Surya Siddhanta, in both these places, and I feel quite comfortable about how it is. Sorry.
So it was really interesting. I thought to share the map also, so I did. Yeah. Now I have a last question, and then maybe it will be the one which I ask after this one, which is related to the book, is about your experience of writing the book and so forth, but that we will do in the end. So this last question from the book is about the Patal Lok and the Rasatals. Now, very interestingly, various lokas have been discussed, but I would like to understand more about the significance of the Patal Lok, because actually there is some description of various kind of soils as well, I think, so if I remember.
Correct.
So it's about Patal Lok and the Rasatals, if you can elaborate about that, I would be more than happy.
So the Patal Lok, just like, so the Devalok has six lokas, Bhuloka, Bhuloka, Swarloka, Janloka, Tapaloka, and Brahmaloka, right? Maharloka, Janloka, Tapaloka. Similarly, there are seven lokas below, right? And so for six of these lokas, the Patal Loka is actually is the name for all these six lokas, seven lokas put together, right? So it is, so Atala, Vitala, Sutala, Rasatala, Mahatala, Talatala, and Rasatala, and then finally Patala. Right? So these are the seven Patala lokas. There are seven lokas. And for six of these lokas, they describe this with the soils. Right. So they describe they start with marshy soil. They start with Atala has having black soil going all the way down to marshy soil, blue soil, and finally rocky soil. So it's useful to think of these. For people that haven't read the book, this might be hard to believe. Just imagine if the oceans of the earth were dry completely, or for most part, right? So what would you see? You would see the side, the earth, the place where we live as being plateaus. Right? There would be plateaus. There'd be high regions of high of height, and then the sides of the ocean, the sides of the ocean basin are finally slowly sloping away till you come to the bottom of the ocean. And at the bottom of the ocean, you will find a very rocky substance, which is the rocks at the crust, literally the crust of the earth, right? And then you'll have the marshy soil and so on and soil till you come all the way to the black soil, which is the Atala soil, and the example of black soil is the Deccan Plateau. Right, the Deccan Plateau is basically volcanic soil that has come up because of volcanic eruptions, and the Deccan soil is black. Right, so you can see the Atala soil has come up because of volcanic eruptions and come up on top of the Deccan Plateau, and the whole region is black soil, and then it has all the various regions of the soil. So this is, initially you think of Patal Lok, you think this, so the Puranas, the Brahmanda Purana gives a description of the soil at each level, but it does not give a description of soil for the Patala itself. And so I presume that the Patala itself, the seventh of the Patala Lok, the furthest of the Patala Lok, is a region in space. It's like a divine region that is not... that is outside the purview of the earth, basically. Just like the Maharloka, the Janaloka, Taparloka are regions of space. This is the region of space, but below the equator, okay? Below the surface of the earth. So, that's one thing that I wanted to call out. The other thing that I think you might find interesting is that you will find, for example, in the Ramayana, you will find that you'd find reference to the Talatala, because Princess Mandodari was either from Talatala or something like that. I'm speaking from memory here, right? So these are, again, this part of the Patala Loka is actually referenced in the other texts as well, as places where people used to reside, where kings used to reside, and they actually married into this place. Or there are stories in the Puranas where they say they went into into the Rasatala. For example, the when the story of Ganga is described, Ganga, when Bhagirathi prays to Ganga and says, "You must come down to earth," Ganga asks him. He says, "If I come down to the earth all at once, it will destroy the planet all the way to Rasatala." Right? So she talks about the Rasatala as a physical layer of the planet Earth. Right? But she does not describe Patala. Patala is the layer below Rasatala. Right? So that is the layer which is a region of space, probably, and so on and so forth. But from Atala to Rasatala seem to be physical regions of the Earth that seem to be pretty well described. Like, again, you have to look at references to this and kind of put this together. And the way I would go about it is I read many of the Puranas end to end, and I would do a digital search in the Puranas, in the PDF of the Puranas, for all references to one story. And then I would assemble all the references to that story and create, okay, what do the Puranas say across all the 18, or across at least most of the Puranas about this one topic? I will collect all this information, and then I'll say, okay, now I think I have what I require to create the narrative. So I don't want to give you or your audience the impression that you can read one story and, oh, okay, now I kind of got it. It's actually a pretty painful process. And I don't know, I don't want to say that maybe painful is a very poor word. It was a labor of love for me. I enjoyed every minute of doing it, and I was blessed that I had the opportunity. So that's how I kind of put this view of the Patala, six Patala Lokas together. The seventh Patala Loka is actually a region of space below the Earth. That's the best of my understanding. Does that make sense?
Yeah, really. I mean, this is so interesting. And that's why I actually wish to know and discuss about it, of course. Okay. Yeah. So I have a final question with two parts. One of them is a fantasy question, and none of this is about your experience with the book. Okay. I'll just tell the questions right away. So the first one is, just for hypothetical purposes, I just wish to understand. Of course, there might be some descriptions about gravity a lot in the Puranas.
Yes.
So, do we see that even similar descriptions to anything which refers related to or like the black hole, which is often described a lot, is found in these? And the second part is about, of course, how have you, your labor of love and your experience with the book?
So how do I say this? There in the Brahma Vaivarta Purana, right? In the Brahma Vaivarta Purana, there is a description of this, what I believe is the center of the Milky Way, right? Now, in the center of every galaxy, there is presumed to be a giant black hole. I'm using the word presumed to be a giant black hole, right? So nobody has seen it. By its very definition, a black hole cannot be observed because it does not easily light. But you can infer a black hole because of the way it bends light, it attracts objects around it, and so on and so forth, right? So there is a lot of physics that goes into it, but obviously you can't observe it. And there is, like I said, there is a description of the center of what I think is the center of the Milky Way. But for me to say that it is the same as the black hole would be a huge leap of imagination. I don't think I would do justice to either science or to Puranas by making that claim. So I just want to lay that out very clearly, right? Because the black hole is a very widely accepted theory, but it is still a theory, right? I mean, you've had a lot of different people, like I said. There was some very very interesting experiments that have been run to prove the existence of a black hole. A very fascinating experiment. But what you don't understand the physics of a black hole very well. And some people can explain some of the things that are ascribed to black holes through other means. They can, you know, figure out other ways to explain the same thing. So it is the most widely accepted theory, but there is nothing that specifically in the Purana that relates to the black hole. I'd be very remiss if I try to claim that. And I want to stay as close to being truthful to both the text and to the science as I can. So that's the first question. That's probably the first thing. Does that make sense? I want to pass out your question into two parts. We find black holes generally at the center of most galaxies, because that's why a center of a galaxy is big and it kind of draw, you know, that's what pulls all the mass in the galaxy together. And so there's a description of the center of the galaxy, but it's not obvious that it's describing a black hole. So I hope I said that clearly enough. In terms of how I wrote this book, I did not write this. I never thought I'd be a writer. Right? So when you grow up, you want to be an engineer. I wanted to be an MBA. I wanted to be a business professional, and I did all that, right? Until I started reading the Puranas, and then I read this over 8 years. It's not like I read my first Purana. I said, okay, I got this. Right? This is all cosmology. I started reading the Puranas because I had a discussion with a friend, and he said that, oh, I'm going to read the story about the story of the great flood, right? The story of Noah's Ark, but it's not from the Bible, but it's from the Egyptian text. It's called the Epic of Gilgamesh. So he said, there's also an Indian version of it. It's called Matsya Purana. But I hadn't read it. I had read about it. I thought, but he said, oh, okay. And we both agreed that he would read the Epic of Gilgamesh. I'd read the Matsya Purana. I had never read a Purana before in my life. I'd never imagined I would read a Purana. And so I said, okay. So since I had given my word to read the Purana, so I ordered a copy and read it. And what followed was some of the most fabulous material that I read. It was such rich text, right? You expect to see a whole bunch of stories, story of this god, that god, he did this, she did that, and so on. It was a text of such sophistication that I was hooked. And I read the Matsya Purana, then I read the Shiva Purana, then I read the Bhagavata Purana, then I read the Brahmanda Purana. And after that, I couldn't find anything in print because nobody reads the Puranas, right? So who will go and print these texts, right? So I had to download this from the internet, and I printed the whole 1,500 pages, the Brahmanda Purana, then I printed the Kalika Purana, then the Devi Purana, and then the Brahma Vaivarta Purana. And I just printed them out and read them because I don't think I've read any other book the last 10 years. It's just fascinating to read these texts. And after you read your fourth Purana, then you realize that many of these stories are repeating themselves, right? Because the story of the moon, the story of the sun. You keep seeing references again and again, and each time it's repeated, it has another piece of detail or a different perspective. And when you read your fourth Purana or your fifth Purana, then you're like, man, I've read this story three times. If I put all of this information together, that's a lot of detail. That's not what you would find in a 2,000-year-old text that describes the stories of God. There is something else going on here. And that is what kind of kicked me off. And that's what set me up. And I said, okay, I need to go back and check my, I need to check back the science. And then I read more about the science, more and more about the science. And then it became painfully obvious. Remember, I was working then, so I used to finish my day's work at 11 o'clock at night, and I'd read from 11 o'clock to 1 o'clock, or I'd read over the weekend. And over a period of time, after some time, I realized that even I wouldn't believe myself, right? So suppose you read a nice book, and you're telling a friend or you're thinking about it, you say, well, I read a book where it's the story of this and this person or something of that sort, right? And I thought to myself, my God, 5 years later, if I were to say that I read about the life cycle of the sun in the Puranas, forget about my telling somebody else. I wouldn't be able to believe myself. So I started, somewhere along the line, I started taking notes. right? So I start, just 1 minute, please. Yeah.
All right. So if there are any questions with regards to the book and whatever we have discussed in the podcast, I'm open to take up the questions to Ganesh, sir. Yeah, I think he's back.
So I started taking notes, right? So I said, because 5 years later, I'd have to go back and listen to read these notes to make sure that, that I actually read what I read. Otherwise, I couldn't believe myself. So I started taking notes, and over a period of 2 years, it became such a body of knowledge that then this thing kept building on itself. And finally, I said, if I don't write a book, I'm going to lose it, basically, right? So I left my job. I didn't leave my job because of this. I left my job. It turned out, and I said, this is the best opportunity I have to write a book, right? And so I took about a few weeks break from my work, and then I started writing. And I was not—I'm not a trained writer or anything of that sort. And I had to teach myself how to write, because the first time I wrote a book, it was awful. I was never trained as a writer. I used to read a lot. I used to read a lot before. And so I know what a good book reads like. I used to be a voracious reader. And I wrote my first draft. It was so horrible that I said, forget it. Forget about anybody else reading it. Even I wouldn't pay 10 rupees for a book like this. So I had to keep reading, rewriting it again and again. And then I had to get some external validation. Right? These are not easy claims to make. So how do you tell a person? I mean, imagine if I went and told my dearest friend, my very dear friend, that I read in the Puranas that it has the life cycle of the sun. What do you think he'll tell me? He'll tell me, Ganesh, go and have a good night's sleep, and then let's talk about it tomorrow morning. Maybe you'd feel better then. Yeah? Maybe you have a temperature or something of that sort. So I had to actually write a draft and show it to him. And I had to request him, do you mind reading it? Does it make sense to you? Then he read it and said, yeah, it makes sense. And then he was from another IIT, he was a very dear friend of mine, very well-read person. Then I gave him another chapter. And he said, yeah, it's logical. I mean, what you say makes sense. And looks like you've done a lot of work. You should do more work and complete it. And so that set me off on the process. After that, the actual process of writing started, where I had to say, okay, now I have to go from a concept to a finished book. And that took another 6 months or so. And like I said, I just had to rewrite again and again, because I'm not trained to write. So I had to basically just figure it out. Fortunately, the book has been received very well. And the reviews, I don't know if you've checked them either on Amazon or in Goodreads, have been quite favorable. And sales have been good. I mean, for a topic like the Puranas by a first-time unknown writer, I had to self-publish it, because nobody would publish a book like this, right? Who's going to publish a book on the Puranas and science by a first-time writer I have no history, I have no expertise in Puranas. I can't look up, tell somebody that I have a PhD in the Puranas, a PhD in astronomy or nothing. So I had to self-publish it, and here we are. I'm glad that I was able to reach out to as many people as I did, including yourself, and that you found it interesting enough to read it and to invite me to your podcast and for us to have this chat. So. Hope that helps. Very long story. It was a very long process. It took almost 2 years for me to write this, which is most people can polish off a book within 3 to 6 months. I had to go back, and the thing is that when you're writing about, you're doing two things. You're writing about science, and so you can't make up science, right? You have to be either right or it's not right. So you have to go back and make sure you're researching it correctly, and it's not fiction. You can't change anything. These are sacred texts, right? So you can't mix stuff up, because the worst thing you can do is make people unhappy that you actually I don't think this interpretation is right or whatever, that you kind of misrepresented the text. These are holy texts. Right? It's not just a work of fiction that I'm reinterpreting or something. So by the grace of God, it's gone well. People have reacted extremely well to it. And that's a story. It's a long 2 years. I've tried to compress it in 5 minutes or so. Hope that makes a little bit of sense to you.
Definitely. It's been a pleasure to have you on board for this episode. And as I said in the beginning also, and even before, that the very reason I wanted to discuss the book with you is that this is not just a normal book, according to my understanding. And this is something which is more about science and about the aesthetics part, which is like how narratives are shared as stories with regards to issues of science, and something which is so obvious sometimes for us, how do we understand it? So I must say that the episode has really gone well, and it has been a pleasure to have you on board, sir. I would really request the audience to buy From the Beginning of Time by Greer, sir. It's available on Amazon, and you can buy it through Kindle, or you can have a paperback or hard copy, if I'm right. So you can definitely have it. It's a very nice book. It should not be ignored for all reasons, whether cultural, whether aesthetic, whether scientific. And maybe I think much work should be done on the Puranas, since I think this is kind of a teaser and kind of a figment of what actually is in the world of it. So, really. And with that, we end with this episode of Indus Think. We will be coming up with a very interesting episode of Global Hint. We will be restarting Global Hint Season 2 on 13th of June with Alex Hochuli from Brazil. We're going to discuss the Brazilianization of the global order. And it's a very interesting article by Alex. I thought that it actually relates with all the global events which are happening right away, from Donald Trump to whatnot. So stay there for Saturday and Sunday. We will be coming up with more episodes soon. And Indus Think will be coming soon again. So never be the same, know the world beyond. And Ganesh, sir, thank you so much again for coming.
Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you very much for having me on your podcast. Have a wonderful day. Thank you.